Hello everybody, James here, and it's Ask Dutch Anything number 15. This is the episode where you get to write in at questionsfordutch@gmail.com and we put your questions, the best ones, to the Dutchman himself, Dirty Dutch Mantel. But before we get to the questions, we have some books to flog, and Dutch has two. Tales from a Dirt Road and The World According to Dutch. Now, if you want them unsigned, you can just go to Amazon.whatever it is, whatever country you're in, and you can get them unsigned. Or if you want them signed, you can put in your request to DirtyDutchMantel with two L's at gmail.com. Make your request there and he will sign it himself and send it out himself to you. And also he has diplomas as well, so if you want diplomas signed by the Dirty Dutchman and of course the Provost Zeb Coulter, you can get those as well. I have two books somewhere, one on the rock, one on Owen Hart, you know the drill, t-shirt somewhere, but I have Shane Douglas's new podcast, Franchise University with Shane Douglas, that you can get on all podcast platforms every Tuesday, and clips and full episodes every single day on Shane Douglas Official, the YouTube channel. And that's pretty much it, Dutch, unless there's something you want to bring up.
You know, you're getting pretty good at this.
I'm trying you've not done to cough this, all the way you, through it.
Well, I was coughing too.
Excuse me.
I think it's that virus going around. And I had it about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago. It kicked my butt. Now, you know, when it was out before and everybody was sick and doing, you know, I think I maybe had a touch of it, but not much. Not any more unusual than what most people get in wintertime anyway. But then about 3 weeks ago, I got something and it kicked my butt. I thought I could, I thought I was going to have to go to the ER and see what they said. So, but my daughter did have it. So I probably caught it from her. And then my granddaughter got it and wife got it and we all got it. But
I think I've just got sympathy coughs from you. You know, like sympathy pregnancy.
Well, if you got it, you know, my condolences to you because it's not fun.
No, I've just got a bit of a tickle going on. But do we ask the questions now or do you want to refer to something that happened with a certain tall guy?
What happened?
You want me to say the beginning of it?
Yeah. So, I don't know what happened, yeah. So this is what I like about this show. Because sometimes you ask me something that I'm not aware of. And I don't research it. I might research it later, but tell me what the story is.
A few weeks ago, you told a story that Kevin Nash at one point went into a pro boxing match, and did he win? I can't remember. He may have won. Anyway, I remember you telling the story.
He told me the story. Yeah, he won, but he said he fought some Cuban guy in Miami, and he says the Cuban guy was just, he'd been a boxer, and Kevin said he just said he beat the crap out of him, but he won, I think Kevin won the fight. Anyway, the story was he went down there and he was all cut up and banged up and he was trying to drive back. And one of the things he said was there's got to be an easier way to make a living than this, which stopped his pro boxing career. So, but what did he say?
Well, the way you said the story, you said, well, it was a boxer. He didn't have a name. Or, you know, like he was like a no-name boxer, lower ranked. So I was thinking, well, what if he did have a name? Then he'd be a famous boxer. And then he'd have dozens of fights. So it's probably good he wasn't that famous. Kevin Nash said something to the effect of, you got the story wrong. Koho says, well, what did he get him wrong? And then Kevin Nash went, I don't want to talk about it. Scintillating podcasting it was, let me tell you.
Well, it was, he was laughing. We was making some trip one time, and I can't tell you where, but I was in the car with Kevin, and he is an entertaining talker. And said he was in night, because he played basketball at the University of Tennessee. And I don't know how he wanted to start boxing, but this promoter guy, this manager, he'd trained for I don't know how many months, want to put him in the first match, but it was in Miami. So he said he drove from Knoxville to Miami. You know how far that is?
Didn't we work out it was over 800 miles, was it?
Oh, it's more than that. I think it was 1,000 miles, to tell you the truth. Because from Jacksonville to Miami is about 400 or 350. Anyway, it was a long, long drive. And he got down, and I told this story before. He said he had this boxer, and this boxer, he said he was hitting him in the ribs because he was a big target. And he said he won the fight, but he got back in the car, and his eye was busted, his nose was hurt, and his chin was banged up. And the thing he said was, there's got to be easier ways to make a living than this boxing business. And he'd laugh, and it was an entertaining story. And I don't know what I got wrong, but if he would tell me, I would correct it.
Mm. Well, apparently he got something wrong, but he doesn't want to talk about it. So there you go. Okay, we're going to tell you. We're going to move on. And as I said before, we've got your questions coming up now. So as I also said before, questions for dutch@gmail.com. If you want your poser posed to the crafty veteran Dutch Mantell at a future episode. Now, the first question we've got, I'm not sure we're going to have an answer for, but I thought I'd ask it anyway. Rob Smith, please talk about Lord Alfred Hayes on TNT. This is in the channel. This is Tuesday Night Titans, the WWF show. He was a face and played the role very well. Earlier times saw him as a heel again. He played the role very well. What was he like in real life? Thank you.
Real life, a very, very nice, I think in English terms, gentleman. He was English or British all day long. That wasn't really a gimmick with him. What you saw with Lord Alfred Hayes is how he was in real life. He never got, he never got weird or, you know, he was always proper, even when he wore the kilts and he'd have he was like an earlier Roddy Piper. But in the dressing room, I remember him as and he was older than I was. I think quite a bit older, but a very, very nice guy. He took time with me and I wasn't around him long. So he was under no obligation to help me at all. And I had a match and I came in the dressing room and, you know, he had watched it and he said, we talked for a second, but he didn't have to do that. So, and I thanked him and I never heard any bad stories, off color stories about Lord Alfred Hayes. I think he was a pretty decent guy.
Where did you meet him? So this is a territory rather than the WWF.
I met him in WWF.
Okay.
It's where I met him. I think it was the first time I was there with,
Boys. With
the Harris Boys, the Blue Brothers. I think I was there. But anytime, I mean, it was when I was there at WWF the first time, it was always like under siege, seemed like. Because nobody seemed settled. They weren't doing well. Sometimes you'd almost go in a hole going out on the road. Shane Douglas, who you do a podcast with.
Every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday. There you go. He told me a story that he got up there and they had him like a teacher, instructor. What was he
Dean,
at that time?
The Dean. Dean Douglas.
The Dean. And he said sometimes he would go in the hole when he went on the road. And what he finally did, I think he just quit. But quitting in WWE, they almost had a system where you couldn't quit. I mean, you could, but you couldn't work for anybody else or they could sue you. Their contracts in those days, I mean, I'm thinking, why did I sign that thing? Because it says on the contract, I wish I still had it, that your total compensation, they would feel their part of the bargain, was they only had to pay you $1,500 for the year. For the year. But they said, oh, don't worry about that because you're on the big show. So you should be making about, I don't know, $3,000 a week. You know, don't worry about that. And then when I finally looked at it and it says, we're just obligated to pay you $3,000 a year. Well, that didn't take much to get there, even on bad payoffs. But you're out on the road, you're paying for a car, you're paying gas, you're eating, renting hotel rooms.
Do you know what else they used to do? I'm sorry to interrupt. I want to ask you. But if you left before your time, yes, they would also withhold like pay-per-view bonuses, stuff like that?
They could. I was there long enough to, but I didn't quit. But yeah, they would withhold that. They was under no obligation to actually pay you. And lawyers have even looked at those early contracts and says, it's all for them, nothing for you. And if you left before your time was up, they could hold you to the contract so you couldn't work for anybody else. They were ruthless. And finally, Shane said, screw it, I'm out of here. And basically, I ended up quitting later and just going home. I don't think he even told him I was leaving. He wouldn't use me anyway. So, but it was a very, very low point for WWE and the talent.
The next question. This chap wants to remain anonymous, so we shall abide by his wishes. Does Dutch have any third hour taping on TBS memories? The place turned into a ghost town of fans like 10 sometimes, and it was freezing.
Oh, my God. They would go to, I think it was Gainesville, Georgia, at some kind of a, it's a building where they could hold concerts and they could hold whatever. But they had the bleachers, I think, that pulled out of the walls. So they would pull one bleacher out or maybe two, and then they would start taping, and they would do 3 hours of original taping. And it was just wrestling, just wrestling. It's not a really, you know, when you put a show on, you say, well, I want the people to understand what's going on. But they didn't give a crap if the people understood it or not. They were just filming for content. It was like forever. Then it would get later and later and later. You know, 3 hours of content means about 5 hours in that building before the people you were through taping. And then that leaves out the parts that when the camera breaks down or the truck breaks down or something is not working. And you'd look at it, the later it got, the more sparsely populated it would be. It would be almost embarrassing. Well, not almost, it was embarrassing to go out to the ring and there'd be like 15 people there all on the hard camera was shooting straight across at them. And they'd sit there. Hell, they were beat to death too. Yay. Oh my God, it was horrible. Yeah, I do remember that, and it's not fond memories.
This might be a bit early for this, but was this the point or was this later at Disney where they had the cheer and boo signs? Do you remember anything like that?
I remember hearing of it. But some of those Disney crowds with TNA, they were hot and cold. Well, and between the tapings, the people could freely move out and the other people would move in. So it was touch and go there too.
Universal, not Disney. Am I right?
It was at Universal. Yep. Yes, you're right. Good thing you're there to check me. I always say, you know, Orlando is like, it is Disney's. That's what it's most famous for. Hmm. But it was Universal Studios.
Yeah, one of my
the
friends.
Soundstage D or something, or four, something like that.
One of my friends has got a house in Hunter's Creek, and they will not lend me their house to go to Disney.
What?
I know.
What kind of friends are those?
Oh, bad one. Yeah. I just thought I'd call them out on the podcast. Let me a house, man.
What are their names?
Yeah, I'll give them another week or so to change their mind, and then I'll shame them.
Do they watch this show?
No, they don't. You know, none of my friends are wrestling fans. None of them. They don't understand what I do.
I don't care. We need to do a special interview just for them. And you says, I played this on the show. Maybe this will help you decide to loan me your house for a week.
It's a nice house.
And then we just come out and just blast them, and we put the phones up underneath and say, please call these ultra rich people.
Yes.
Share with the common man. See?
It's even got a little swimming pool with a little cage around it, like all those places in Hollywood, Orlando.
And they won't loan it to you?
Oh, God.
Have you offered to pay for it?
God, no. You must be joking. We'll pay a penny.
So he knows you very well.
Oh, very well, yeah.
Oh, okay.
We shall move on. Spencer Yates, pro wrestling has always had colorful people in it. You've always said never let the truth get in the way of a good story. However, I don't think anyone would consider you a liar. We have all heard the tall tales from guys like Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Bruce Pritchard, Shawn Michaels, Greg Garnier, Paul Heyman, Mike Graham, Manny Fernandez, and Dusty Rhodes. Some fun little stories, others just straight up bullshit. But I would love to know who you, would be on your Mount Rushmore of wrestling liars. Thank you very much.
Well, Ric Flair would hold the number one spot. And
what would he lie about? Because you've said that before. I mean, obviously,
everything. He lies about everything. You say, Rick, sun shining, no, it's dark as hell. And you could look out and say, well, it's 12 o'clock in daytime. Oh, I didn't say that. He'll deny saying it. But everything, and I've said on our last podcast, Ric Flair is a damn narcissistic bastard, really, because I don't know care what the story is, it will come back to him as the main feature of the story. Oh, so-and-so died. Oh, yeah, he's a good day. But, you know, I helped that guy do this and this and this and this. And, you know, it all comes around back to Rick, and he cannot tell the truth. I don't think he's capable of telling the truth. Cause he said, I remember the worst thing he ever said was he was there when Bruiser Brody got killed. Everybody, and you can research that. Now he's finally come out and said, no, I really wasn't there, but I was going to go there. Okay. That's probably truthful, but he didn't want to say that. He said he was there and this is what happened. And so he's in the number one spot on the Mount Rushmore of
wrestling liars.
Non-truthful people.
I want to qualify that. Ric Flair, when he said that, it was on an RF video shoot when he said, oh yeah, I was there. And even the guy who's asking the questions were like, what, were you? Oh, yeah, I was definitely there. And then he later claimed that he never said he was there, even though he said it on video. So, yeah. Sorry, but number two.
Okay, number two is a guy that we talked about last week that didn't mean anything by anything malicious by saying this, this, and this. But according to him, he's done everything. Is my old tag team partner, Bobby Jaggers. And he was, but I overlooked his non-truths as entertainment. Oh, and then we got to a point, he would say something and I would agree with him. And I would go, did you do this? Oh yeah, I did that. And then, because he's been everywhere. He's done everything. But at least he told stories that you knew were not true. But he was so entertaining when he did it that I overlooked it. Give me the rest of that list.
Of what this fella Spencer Yates has said, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Bruce Pritchard, Shawn Michaels, Greg Garnier, Paul Heyman, Mike Graham, Manny Fernandez, Dusty Rhodes.
Hulk Hogan is the next one. He is, I mean, he embellishes every story, which I am really an advocate for. Never let the truth, you mentioned it earlier, never let the truth get in the way of a great story. But at least people tell stories that are somewhat believable, just a little bit. And Flair and Hogan both have that same attribute of, you know, I want to be the center of this. And they always are. Okay, another one. Give me another one.
Do you want the list again?
Yep. No, well, not the ones I've named.
Bruce Pritchard, I don't know why Shawn Michaels, Greg Garnier, Paul Heyman, Mike Graham, Manny Fernandez, Dusty Rhodes.
Well, I'm going to have to pick. I don't know what Mike Graham has said, but I've read some of the things he said. He's way off base, too. Totally off base. He's not with us anymore. I'm not going to talk bad about him. But he could really take a true story and twist it to where it's, I don't know, he would change the whole story. That you know, he would tell people of something that happened, and they were there, too. So, and Manny was another one, but he's entertaining guy. But, and I would put in the fourth spot, Paul Heyman, because he's told guys that work for him that this and this and this is going to happen. And they wanted to be in wrestling so badly, they would go into debt to keep wrestling. And one of them was Chris Candido. Chris Candido, I don't know if he actually told me, but he said he had something like he would help Paul with the tickets to buying airline tickets. And he said he put $31,000 of tickets on his card, but Paul never paid him. So that's why he was, when I went to Puerto Rico, that's why he was down there on the beach, sleeping on the beach, didn't even have a place to stay. And I'm saying, damn, has it come to this? Of course, Paul, he won't say anything about it, but I did catch him when I was in WWF the first time. He was changing tickets. Yeah. And I didn't know what he was doing, because every time we'd have a layover, he would be at a ticket window. I said, what is he doing? And they said, what? And they finally told me he takes tickets and he changes them into his name. He may upgrade it, but the ticket comes in his name. So he would actually cancel the ticket or find a cheaper flight. He would cancel that ticket and take what was left on it. Some of those tickets were like $800,000, $900,000, where if you knew what you're doing, you could get the ticket for $200. So he'd get it in his name, cash it in, $1,000, he'd leave. Because the WWF's name was never on the ticket. It ended up in his name, so therefore, if he wanted to change it or get a refund, he could.
Yeah, WCW specifically, not WWF. Also,
you're right. You're right. Because listen, what's the motto here?
Never let
the truth get in the way of a good story.
But someone, I don't know where I heard this, but it was recent, that Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan tell stories like the internet doesn't exist. Let's move on. Now, Ron Garner has said, has there ever been a one-on-one match between Kamala and Abdullah the Butcher?
Not that I've seen. Can you research it real quick?
I actually looked up before we started. I could find some matches with them tagging up together, I think in Japan, but I don't think they've ever gone one-on-one. I may well be wrong, but yes.
Since, what's that guy's name?
Ron Garner.
You know, Mr. Garner, since you mentioned it, I would be interested in seeing a match between Abdullah and who's the guy he named?
Kamala Abdullah.
Oh, Kamala. I would be really interested in seeing that. And Kamala was another guy who was a really, really good guy. Really good guy. And he said he never got paid in WWE like he should have been paid. And I don't know if that's true or not. But it happens to everybody, because they don't pay everybody the same, because they have different obligations to different guys. So, and we talked about this last week too. The guy could be in second match. You could be the main event. And he could make more than you. So it was a screwed up system. And there's no way to tell what WWE paid somebody else, paid you, because you never saw anybody. And that was strongly encouraged. Do not talk to anybody about your money. And if they heard it, they just fire you.
Now, Kamala, just while you were talking then, I had a look. Now, this is, I'd pretty much wager this is not true, to at least the point that Kamala's saying. Survivor Series 1992, business is already falling off. 92 is one of the worst years for the WWF in history. Undertaker versus Kamala in a coffin match, not a casket match. This was still the coffin match, I think. Kamala claimed that he made $10,000 and the Undertaker made approximately $500,000.
Well, I don't know if he made $500,000. That's a lot of money, even back in those days. But I do believe he could have made $10,000. I was on the first pay-per-view I was on. It was in 1993. All I did was walk to the ring. I didn't have anything. And it was against Davey Boy. And I forgot his partner.
It was Lex Luger.
I made $7,500, I think, for just walking to the ring. And think that that Kamala made $10,000. And like I say, but not everybody's pay is the same. They wanted to keep Undertaker and push him. And basically, Kamala could do what he wanted to do. He could move on if he wanted to.
Let me give you an example. Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior, a year before at SummerSlam 1991, both were bonused or paid $75,000 each.
Possible.
So there's $500,000 for The Undertaker for Survivor Series. I cannot see that happening.
I can't see that either. I can see that he made a lot more than Kamala. I can see that. I don't think Vince is that generous with some of the guys. I don't care who they are. He's got to make money too.
$50,000, maybe. I can see it. Maybe. He didn't have his glasses on. He saw an extra zero. Like,
maybe.
You said
let me call and ask him. I'm going to call and ask him.
Who, Kamala?
No.
Understand.
Well, that'd be good if I could get a hold of Kamala.
Hey, that'd be an exclusive, let me tell you.
That would be great podcast stuff. I'll call up Undertaker and ask him.
You said Kamala was a great guy.
Yeah, he was.
Tell a story.
Okay, we're in Mid-South. We're not really making any money. And we're in some Mississippi town. And Mississippi is notoriously African-American. And that's what the crowd was. Not you know, that's okay with me. And I walk in the dressing room, and there's Kamala, who is one of the top heels in the territory. He's laying on the floor with his shirt off and shorts on and no shoes. And he just laying there. I call it wallowing. He was there just wallowing around, and he turned over and he was on top in the territory and sticking out of his back pocket. I looked and I said, "What is that?" He says, they're food stamps. I said, "Why?" He said, "Yeah, we get food stamps." So he didn't tell them he's working in WWE, so he could go down to the local office and say, "Hey, where's my food stamps?" But he said it's for his mother, it's for this, but he had them on him. So He's taking what they were offering, and I don't really blame him, but to see the top heel of the territory with food stamps, and I'm saying, is it that bad that you got to get help with your food?
Man, Kamala and Payoffs, hey? They just don't seem to go together.
Oh,
we will move on. Dan Groves. Many years ago, there was a dirt list of parts made up and parts real salacious rumors about wrestlers. One of them centered around David Flair getting rudely awakened by Victor Quiñones while David was staying in his apartment. Is there any truth to these rumors?
Well, I'm going to say this. There's truth to Victor Quiñones, who was the promoter of a company. He pulled away from the main company that was run by Carlos Colon. And yeah, there is truth to Victor you know, liking guys. So I believe that he could, what he would do, he would get drunk. I mean, falling down stone-faced drunk about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And if he probably saw David in the bed, he would jump into bed with him. I kind of believe, I've never seen it happen, but I do believe that story because he looks like the type that Victor liked. And Victor, when he died, Victor, when he died, was living with a guy in Puerto Rico, and the guy controlled his money and everything. So, and I predicted Victor would pass away about 2 years before he died. I said, what's going to happen, Savio? And I was working down there. I said, you guys are going to wake up one day and get news that Victor Quiñones has died. He said, oh, no. I said, okay. Because he did a lot of drugs, drank a lot of beer, a lot of liquor, and it was his lifestyle. The drugs were going to get him. And it did. So I don't know what kind of drugs he was on. I don't know if he was on anything, you know, like a shoot up. But I've seen him a few times. He could not even talk. He was so messed up. So, and he would run these shows and he would draw big. They draw like 80 grand, 90 grand, maybe more. And he was taking that money. And I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot of money to be taken out of here and let somebody know about it. Because they could stop you on the road and pop a few caps and get out of that money. So, but that never happened to him. But he did pass away. I think they judged it an overdose.
David Flair was in Puerto Rico?
Yeah.
You booked
him? That's another story.
Okay, right then.
So they call me, and Carlos comes up to me and he says, Ric Flair called me. I said, okay. He wants us to book his son, David. And I'm thinking, oh, God, he's going to be the shits. And he said, if we would book him, he'll come down here and he'll make a couple of shows for us. So I call Rick. And he said, yeah, I'd like to send him down there to get some experience. And he said, don't worry about the money. He says, I just need you in exchange for me. I don't know if he said, don't worry about the money, but he said, I'll waive my regular appearance fee. But he said, I just want you to take him and try to work with him 4 or 5 months. I want him to see what a territory is like. And then I says, and in exchange, he said, I'll make a couple of appearances down there for you guys. Okay. So we take David, greener than hell. And he's learning the business. And of course, I'm having him get beat because he wasn't good enough to even approach a main, even in Puerto Rico, he wasn't good enough to even be in a main event ring because he was like, they were giving him things I was giving him things that really, if I don't let him win, I was giving him things that he would fail at. So we got to working around a little bit and I called Rick. I said, I give him a date. Can you make this show? Oh, man, I'm in somewhere else. I said, okay. Then I called him again a month later. I said, listen, we're doing this big show in the stadium. It'd be great to anchor it down with you. Oh, that's full. That's full. I'm going to book somewhere else. So, damn. And it got down to finally, I forgot what happened to David. I left. I said, I'm tired of dealing with it. I'm gone. And I think David just picked up in the middle of the night and left too. About 3 weeks after I left. I mean, I know he left after I did. But Rick never repaid the favor. He never come to Puerto Rico. And he just, I mean, he didn't live up to his end of the bargain is what it was. So that's, like he knows Puerto Rico. I think he's been down there. I don't know how many times he was there, but not much. But it was a crazy time down there. But he never made the two appearances for us, and we were going to pay him.
Well, David Flair, I think by the time he left IWA was towards the end of 2003, and he may have been the reigning IWA Intercontinental Champion at the time. So apparently you left, and then they started making him a champion.
No, I left about, when did he leave?
So the last match I can see him is the end of the end of November 2003. You left September or something, maybe?
Something like that.
TNA?
I left, and so that would have been a thing I would have never done. I'd never put a title on him. But he may have had, you know, he's a blonde guy out there walking around. He gets heat just by being a blonde guy. But I don't know if he was getting heat off that, but enough. He got attention on him. Victor Quiñones noticed him. So, and I've seen a lot of guys down there that get booked. And the story was that they were booked by Victor because he wanted them around. Mm-hmm. So, and I've had a lot of guys tell me down there that he would like them a little bit, and he'd take them out to eat, and he was feeling them, and they was pushing him off. But they want a job in wrestling, so they can't punch him. That would end. He was the owner. But, hey, I work with some dysfunctional people. So, and what if somebody told me, I go, well, whatever, it's Puerto Rico. That's the way I justified everything. Well, it's Puerto Rico. What do you want me to do about it?
How come David was, I mean, he was in the business about three, four years at this point. I mean, working in WCW as well. So, you know, he was working regularly until it closed.
He was the shits.
Well, that's what I'm asking. He's Ric Flair's son. How could the apple have fallen that far from the tree, talent-wise, in that sense?
He had no talent. I mean, he could put trunks on and boots and wear a robe out there, and he could be a David Flair, whatever. He was developing his character, I guess, but he could do the woo. He could do that, and the people would look and say, yeah, he looks like Flair, yeah, till they get used to him. But he wasn't ready to do any kind of an angle with, because he would actually do more damage than it would do him good. It's hard to say that you put somebody in there, and I didn't put him in there with Carlos or any of the big guys, because they're not going to sell him at all. They would just, and he was a little bitty. Yeah, he wasn't that small. He looked like he was about 200-something pounds. He was okay. But they just, I mean, when they get in there, the fans could tell that David Flair was mismatched against everybody. He looked like a beginner wrestler. He looked like he'd just come out of wrestling 101 and was trying to look like and talk like a wrestler. So you can portray it, but can you do it?
Next question. Now, this is actually going to be a bit of a longer one because I've added something to this as well. But DS has asked, why do you think it was hard for Brutus the Barber Beefcake to find any kind of reliable character or direction in WCW? After leaving legally, the Brutus gimmick couldn't be used out of WWF. Was it, I got the job, so give me whatever character you want? Or was Beefcake just not that creative and only had the one good idea for a character? Now, I've added to this, because obviously I know you weren't in WCW at the time, and you probably weren't watching. Eric Bischoff recently made mention of Beefcake, and basically by make mention, I mean buried him. This is what Eric said about Beefcake going into the NWO in 1998. He didn't have it, and Leslie, this is Ed Leslie, as a performer, was a very, very weak performer. He was great at being the barber, but he didn't have the talent or instinct to adapt and to embrace a character that would appeal to the 18 to 49-year-old demographic. It was classic square peg, round hole, and it didn't work. And we were forced. Well, he's the Brutus, that he was the booty man, and then he was the disciple, and then he was whatever else he was. All of that was a reflection of the fact that we couldn't find anything to make this guy work. But he was part of the package, I presume part of the package with Hogan. And we had to give him some time and put him in a position where he could do the least damage to the product. That's horrible to have to say, but it's true. Beefcake.
100%. Why couldn't they give him something that made it work? The guy, face it, the guy's connection to pro wrestling was Hulk Hogan. and they got him a job. Well, what? So what if you're sitting in creative one day? Hey guys, the barber Beefcake coming in, we're going to change his gimmick. What can we give him? Well, he may have been okay as the barber. I don't see him drawing any money, but I agree with him that the Beefcake was a barber was he couldn't work it. He couldn't refine it. He couldn't define it. He couldn't do anything with it. And the other stuff they gave him, what else did Bischoff say they gave him?
Oh, I can give you even more. In the WWF, he was the man with no face. He was the man with no hair. He was the man with no pubes. In WCW, he was the booty man who just shook his arse at the fans, and that was it. And he, Diamond Dallas Page's wife, Kimberly, was his manager. He was the disciple, which was basically a beard. He just had a beard and sunglasses, and he'd hit the gym. You couldn't even tell it was Beefcake. He was almost just like he was Hogan's bodyguard in the NWO in 1998. And I think a lot of people, maybe even quite a few still, will still not know that Disciple was Beefcake.
But I didn't know that.
Yeah. So essentially, that's it. He had an awful lot of characters, but Beefcake was the only one that was a big deal.
Well, I agree with Mr. Bischoff, the guy just didn't have it. There's a lot of guys that have been pushed. They don't get over because, you know, the gimmick has to match the wrestler's personality to make the people believe. I've seen guys change on shows. I'll give you a main thing. The fabulous ones in Memphis, Stan Lane and what was his name?
Kern. Steve Kern.
Yeah, Stan Lane and Steve Kern, right. Individually, and I've said this before, they were good performers. They couldn't draw any money. But they put them together and juiced them up, made them look like something special, put those sequin jackets on and walked out there to the song. They were going out. They were over from the beginning. People would just come see the fabulous ones because they portrayed them as big stars. So that's what they did. And they could work too. And the gimmick matched them, you know, all the sharp dressed man and all this, it really, really worked. But they gave them something, and this wasn't a creative team. This was just Jerry Jarrett's idea, but he hit on it. And say we would go to Nashville on Saturday night. The last week's card was okay. Maybe a half a house. But the fantastic show up. I mean, the fabulous ones show up. It's full. And I said, damn. And that's how I learned. I said, you put something on the people like, you know, it might sell a ticket or two. And it did. And those guys, they do the strut, you know. Jackie Fargo was a big name there, and he would strut back and forth like this, and people would go nuts for it. Is it wrestling? No. Is it good entertainment? Hell yeah, because the people, they bought it. They bought a ticket to see it, and that's your sign of success when you can go to a building where last week you did a, say, maybe 1,500 people. And show up without an angle, with just a gimmick, and you do 3,000 people. That means that it's working. So they were a good team and drew a lot of money.
It's funny you mentioned the Fabulous Ones, because weirdly, Beefcake, the character, especially the earlier version of the character, he had the struts, he had the sequins, he had a lot of things that were actually quite similar to the Fabulous Ones, even though they're completely different characters. Very quickly, did you ever share a locker room with Beefcake?
I met him, but I never was around him too much.
No. Okay, we'll move on. We'll get through as many as we can before the time is up. Sean Smith, did you enjoy being a title holder while you were in professional wrestling? Also, was it a pain in the butt to have to carry around championship belts or trophies everywhere you went?
Well, we never had trophies. We may have had just for TV. We didn't carry it around. And the belt sometimes was a pain in the butt because you'd have to pack it up. Plus, you know, your bag, and especially in summertime, you take off your performing gear, it's wet. And then the belt gets wet and it's a mess. Then the leather kind of falls to pieces on it. No telling how many people have had it. But, and did it make you more money? Possibly, but most of the time it didn't. So you're stuck with carrying the belt around, representing the whole company. But a lot of promoters didn't look at it that way. They're going to pay you. How are they going to pay you? And if anybody needed a some kind of a group of guys to join up to form a union, we needed it back then. But the union wouldn't work because all the promoters do, they would rather shut down than pay guys what they would sign to do. They wouldn't do it. So what would happen if they ever tried to, and we've talked about this before, sign a union, the big stars would stop that. Unless the big stars went, you can forget that union stuff.
I know you're not very sentimental about titles or anything like that, but in your career
I am very sentimental. Go ahead.
Are you?
No.
Okay. But do you have a particular belt or title run that meant more to you than the others in your career?
Not really. To me, it was a job. They hand you a belt as a part of the story. I mean, that's understood. But no, I never wanted to. Like if somebody was about to take the belt from me, I don't give a shit. Just pay me. That's what it says in front of wrestler. Pro wrestler, which means pro means you get compensation for your work in the ring. No, I was never sentimental about any belt at all. And I've had about 40 or 50 of them. Most of them I can't even name by now. But I had a belt in Louisiana that I can't even know. I don't even know the name of. What was the name of that one? It's too late to research. But
you,
the Snowman.
You were South TV champion at one point, were you?
That's what it was, the TV champion.
Is it a medal for some reason? I'm thinking it's like a medal or something.
That's the same thing. Yeah. But did I have a good time with it? No. A medal. That's a hell of a belt. That's a cheap-ass belt. It's like this. You wear it out there. It's like this big. And you wear it, and you can't hit anybody with it. It doesn't do any damage. So it was, no, I don't have any feelings about sentimental belts. I don't.
Let's move on then. I think we've got time for who knows how much time we've got. Yeah, a couple more I think will do. Patrick says, hello, Dutch and James. I'm a huge Undertaker fan. However, I have never really cared too much for the American Badass Biker Undertaker gimmick that you mentioned, in fact, on Friday. Undertaker himself said that he felt he needed to make a change back in 1999 because the Dead Man was getting stale. How would Dutch have booked The Undertaker between 2000 and 2003? How do you evolve The Undertaker to keep him fresh at that point in time? I'm asking this because I know Dutch wasn't a big fan of Biker Taker either. Thank you. Love you. Love you. There you go.
Well, when I first saw that gimmick, it was too much of a change, too much of a shock for them. And they were always comparing, or I was always comparing under to the biker gimmick. What was his name? Bad Outlaw. What was his name?
Who were we talking about?
Mark Calloway, the Undertaker. What, when he rode the bike out, what was he? American Badass?
Yeah, he's just the American Badass, yeah. With the Kid
and
Rock
it was
song.
Kind of, it's like you took away the dong. You took away his entrance, which is the first thing they did. They tried to cover it up with the Undertaker taking all his Undertaker gear off and going down to the ring and like handling a motorcycle. It didn't fit. It felt like a letdown. And it was a letdown. The fans, he kept it a couple of years, but it still, that gimmick never resonated at all till he went back to being the Undertaker. They wanted to see him as the Undertaker. It's almost like you have a little kid and they got a pacifier But instead of giving them a pacifier, you give them a broomstick or something. They don't like that. So until they went back and put Undertaker back under the hat and the long black robe and the looks and the gloves, you know, he was just wandering around in no man's land. So, yeah, the Undertaker was getting old, but that's what you have creative for. They just didn't have anything for him. But before I would have let him go out there and kind of, I think he embarrassed himself. It didn't mean to. And Vince didn't mean to. But as a fan, I'm going to talk as a fan now. As a fan, I never was a fan of the biker gimmick at all. And he loves motorbikes. He loves motorcycles. He loves them to death. I used to go over to his house when he would base out of Nashville. He would have two or three motorcycles there. And these are not cheap motorcycles. These motorcycles, like back then, 50 grand, 40 grand. I mean, that was a lot of money to pay for a bike. And he loved bikes. So, but anyway, I think he didn't really hurt the character. He just didn't help it. And how did he go back being the Undertaker? He just showed up?
He, in late 2003, was feuding with Kane. There may have been a match between the Undertaker and Vince McMahon, and then Kane comes back to help Vince McMahon win in like a Buried Alive kind of thing. And then they start playing vignettes for about 5 months and, you know, doing the effects and the lights going out and the ring moving and that kind of thing. So, Kane, I am coming back. Yeah. Rest in peace, that kind of thing. And then he shows back up at WrestleMania 20 in the sort of hybrid Undertaker. So he's like the original Undertaker, tiny bit of the American biker thing in it, but it's sort of like an amalgamation of everything. And then Paul Bearer returns with him briefly as well.
Well, that's a much better introductory comeback. I didn't see that. I was doing something else. But at least I never believed in disappointing fans. I think the American Badass disappointed them. I don't think nobody bought a ticket to see American Badass, but they would buy a ticket to see Undertaker because his whole entrance is a spectacle. You know, sometimes it took him between 5 and 10 minutes to even get in the ring. And the music is playing, and that was part of his deal. And the people, when they didn't get to see that, they were disappointed, I think. And the way you told me they brought him back was a good way.
Yeah, they made it a bit more supernatural again. They reintroduced the Kane feud and Paul Bearer and everything. I would like to, for what it's worth, add what I think, because I was 15, 14 when he came back. So sort of like peak WWF fan age. I thought the first year or so when he came back as American Badass, I was fine with it. There's some point in maybe 2002, he cuts his hair. And then it just changed the whole... It didn't look like Undertaker anymore. It looked like Business Taker. it didn't have the same impact. And then he sort of rode that out for another 18 months. And then, like, at one point, I think Jim Ross tried to start calling Booger Red. And then they started giving him bad nicknames. I don't even know what it means.
Booger Red.
Red. I don't know.
That didn't catch on.
No, it didn't. And that's when Taker really was stale.
You were disappointed in the evolution of The Undertaker.
Yeah, the original American Badass thing I thought was fine. What I was really disappointed in as a fan was the previous incarnation of The Undertaker was the corporate ministry and the Ministry of Darkness. And then, you know, the character of The Undertaker is most outlandish. You know, he's putting people on the symbol, which is actually a cross. But, it's The Undertaker symbol. And just taking people's souls and having a gang of dark ne'er-do-wells with him. That was great. Then Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara, they rushed through about 40 years worth of storylines in 2 seconds. And then they ruined that when Vince McMahon was then revealed to be the higher power, which was stupid because it made no sense. And then shortly afterwards, The Undertaker then ends up teaming with The Big Show. And then... That tag team had no cachet. You know, no one was interested in seeing yep. that, those two as a tag team. And then The Undertaker got injured, and then he took about 8 months off. Then he turned out to be the American, I am an American badass. And then the song came out, and Are You Scared? He's Here. I quite liked it for the first year, and then it grew stale a bit too quickly.
Oh, yeah. I think it grew stale right when he came out with it. I mean, but I'm not a regular fan. I cannot judge the other fans' reaction to when he changed his gimmick, but I can judge mine. And I went, I saw it right off the bat. I said, this looks like crap. I didn't like it. And they changed him, which means he wanted to change, or they needed his gate ability to sell some tickets. Badass, I don't think, sold any.
Hey, they had The Rock and Steve Austin on the roster. They didn't need no one right. else at that time. But anyway, we will move
but
on.
But even using Undertaker doing The Rock and the Stone Cold Steve Austin era, you actually would lose the benefit of having Undertaker at full strength. Mm-hmm. I mean, he would be underneath those guys, but he's got to see, these are legendary characters. They didn't know that at the time. But I told Steve Austin one time, listen, I give him his name. I didn't give him Stone Cold. I named him Steve Austin. But I could see that this guy had something. And it's a lot like I see when I see that kid, Knight, L.A. Knight, because he puts off some Steve Austin vibes and a little bit of The Rock's vibes. So, and that's what Kevin Nash was calling him, right? He's a cop-out for The Rock and Stone Cold. So, but I don't care what he puts out. I just like to know what I feel about him, because I don't think anybody else's opinion matters. If I'm buying a ticket, they're not buying a ticket. I'm buying the ticket. So, and they found out that they had a little bit of merchandise selling that they're getting out of him. And so he worked his way into a good spot. And great talker, too.
This will probably be the last question. George Carl, one for each of you. So I've got one here as well. Dutch, how did you start your career in wrestling? And did you plan to make it a lifetime thing? And then I'll ask the mind to myself in a second.
How did I start my career in wrestling?
Yeah, and was it full-time when you started in your mind?
Well, I think I lost a bet, and I had to start wrestling. No, I started wrestling in Georgia, and it was full-time. And I'd only had about, I don't know, maybe 20 matches, maybe. But with a talent that I was better than, because we were horrible, and I was horrible then, and I ended up getting a job. And then it was by Tom Ernesto, who was one of the original Assassins. He was booking Georgia, and I became the de facto driver for Tom. He booked me on all these shows, and most of the time we would take his car and I'd drive, which I thought was great, because he'd talk Booker wrestling, not wrestling. And I asked one time, how do you be a Booker? He said, I don't know. He says, but I said, what makes it go? He said, well, stories and common sense. And you find, and he told me, he said, you get somebody over, then you see where it goes. See, a Booker looks at it. He said, where can this go? And he'll take it in a direction. And he may take it in a direction that they go with. But if he takes it in a direction, they're kind of reluctant to do it. Now you got to pull it back a little bit. That's where I got to say, never take something too so far that you can't bring it back. So, and I've always done that, because I've always listened to the fans, how they reacted to where I wanted to take a character. But anyway, I started in Georgia, had a bunch of matches, and rode up and down the road with the veteran, Tom Ernesto, who told me all these stories. I was going to college, listening to him, telling me these things. And then I would get to the building, and I would go out in the usually the first match, and I would go 15 minutes. They called it Broadway, a 15-minute draw. It's where I learned to actually work in front of people. And then we get in the car that night going back, and he would tell me, don't do this, don't do that, slow down. And that's where I actually learned to work. So, and that's how I got in it, Carl.
And one for me is, James, when do you get involved in wrestling? I've never been involved in wrestling. And how many hours a week do you spend researching, interviewing, editing, and watching shows? Any, what else have you written? It's on the next page.
I want to take a guess. Can I take a guess?
Go on.
About 50, 60 hours a week.
I'm sure I complained about that before we started recording. You know exactly what I told you.
I remembered it.
For God's sake, I can't even read my own thing here. It's half a question on one page and half the other. It says, any behind-the-scenes help? Oh, that's it. Yeah, I work about, I don't know, 50, 60 hours a week on this. I'm really tired. And I was actually talking to people, two separate people today, complaining, like I normally do, saying I'm really overworked and, you know, I've got everything else going on in real life that I complain to you about every week as well. And, yeah, I need to... The one thing I don't do is the editing. I leave that to editor Chris, and he also, I'm trying to get him to start doing the social media stuff as well. But man, I mean, what was it, three podcasts a week or three video edits? I mean, recording for like what? Producing like something like 6-7 hours worth of content every week, and that takes a lot.
So you're a content creator.
Yes, but I remember asking you this, and I, because me and Chris were actually arguing with this, am I in wrestling? And I said, no, I'm wrestling adjacent. I'm a content creator who deals in wrestling. But mm-hmm. I would never presume to say that I'm in the wrestling business.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Why did you pick wrestling?
Yeah, I was a massive fan in the when I was very young. So, and
but
then
you don't really watch it now, do you?
I haven't got the time. Even if if I had to review all the major wrestling shows in a week, how many hours would that run? I mean, WWE be five. AEW would be five, let's say. So that's 10 hours, not including pay-per-views and stuff. I would just run
NXT.
NXT, so that's 7, 12, 13, what, 13? And then if there's a pay-per-view, that's be like 16 or 17 hours every week.
And then TNA or Impact.
That'd be another two, so 19.
MWL or whatever they call it.
They don't count.
The NWA, they don't count?
No, MLW wouldn't. I mean, if it was the NWA, that'd be another hour or so. So, you know, look, like to be a wrestling fan these days, it's a full-time job. And the fact is that I already work 50, 60 hours a week doing all these podcast things. So I can only keep up with the major news. You watch SmackDown. You keep up with all the news as well. And what we're doing more and more on this podcast is we're making sure to, if we're going to talk about something, we'll actually watch it now, because before, in the early days, we were, you know, we wouldn't actually see, or, you know, we'd maybe just look at a write-up or something like that. Whereas now, you know, I'll send you a list of videos before we start every week, and I'll say, this is your homework for the week. Make sure you watch all these things, you know, like the Iron Claw trailer or NXT and The Undertaker confronting Bron Breakker, and we'll do it that way. But at some point, I need someone... I don't write in with your CVs, by the way, everybody. But I need someone to do script writing, and I need someone to do the thumbnails, because they're two things that take a huge amount of my time. And, yeah, they're two things I really need to do. But I'm going to train up Chris. I'm probably going to hire somebody else either late this year or early next year to help with script writing. I've got a couple of people in mind anyway that I think would be good for it. But, like writing scripts for this is really, really not as easy. Because how many pages did I send you today?
Oh, well, I didn't get pages. I got like content. I just read it on my phone.
Yeah. How many times do you fall asleep reading it? Because it's like,
Well, I like when you send, hey, a little homework, and it's brief. Today, it took me about at least 30, 40 minutes to read it.
Yeah.
And review the video clips you sent me. So. Actually, it made for a good show. It really did.
So there you go, really. So that's your answer. I work really hard. this. I don't know, it seems really, really easy as well doing this, but also keep in mind that I've got a light here, that direction on my face, that all it does after about an hour and a half just gives me a proper headache. So every single time recording, all I do is get a headache. I've got a pack of ibuprofen that I have right next to me at all times. So I bang two of those before every show I do, so it sort of stays off the worst of the migraine as well. It's all complaining and stuff, but yeah.
You need to stop bitching.
Yeah.
You found we have almost 100,000 subscribers, and we appreciate every one of you. But we do get some great fan mail.
Mm.
We do get that. And if you got, if something you don't like, tell us.
Tell Dutch.
And we'll, yeah, tell me, and then I'll call you, leave your phone number, and I'll call you back and just berate the hell out of you, saying you don't know what the hell you're talking about. And now we appreciate every subscriber. And it's a little late to be doing this, but I would like to say condolences to everybody in the Middle East. They're going through hell right there right now. And I'm kind of concerned about it, but it's their problem and they got to straighten it out. So if you're in the Middle East or anybody, you know anybody, I hope everybody's okay.
Yeah, I actually sent someone a message from someone I know who vaguely who's there as well. So I said, you know, best wishes and everything to them as well. Read, if you are bored and you want the most mind-bending history, read the history of Israel. It is the most convoluted 80 it years is. Of history, modern history. Because I like modern history.
Is Gaza the world's biggest open-air prison? That's what they call it.
Yeah.
You know, 10 million people are there. And they're wanting people to leave, but how do they leave?
I think I don't know. I think it's like, don't even get me. I think they've got some favored. They've got some nations who are favorable to them. I think like Iran's one of them. But anyway, for now, before we misquote world news and politics and stuff like that, we will thank you for watching. Remember, questions for Dutch at gmail.com. If you want your questions submitted for consideration to be asked at a future episode. But for now, thank you very much, Dutch. We the people.
We the people.